Greetings. We're back. We're going to resume our study, and we're to take up today some good samples of proofs of the existence of God that have been given over the centuries, particularly by Christian thinkers. There are also Jewish thinkers who have given proofs of the existence of God. There are Muslim thinkers who have done so, but it's mainly the Christian tradition that has been rife with them. Augustine had three proofs of God's existence. St. Anselm famously gave one that people still debate today. But the high point, and especially up and through the Middle Ages, were the five proofs of St. Thomas Aquinas. St. Thomas died around 1278. I've seen 1277 in print. I've seen 1278. It's somewhere around there. And he gave five proofs, and today we're going to look at his third proof. And I have it already written on the board, so I'm going to go over here now and go through the premises with you. In a logical proof, we have premises and then we draw a conclusion. The first premise of this argument is, some things are such that they can exist or not. That, of course, is the truth of observation. You just look around the world and it's hard to see anything that you think isn't like that. Certainly, anything we can think of seems to be of such character that either it could exist or not. It could be destroyed. So all he says is, some things are like this, where the word some in logic means at least one. There's at least one thing that's such that it can exist or not. And we in fact know that just about everything we can see and think of is like that. But now premise two might need some explaining for you. Here Thomas says, whatever can fail to exist must at some time do so. And you might wonder why in the world he thinks that. Notice that this premise is much more strongly worded than the first one. The first is simply an observation of a matter of fact. But the second says, whatever can possibly not exist must at some time not exist. It's not a possibility, merely a possibility. If it's possible, it must happen. Why would he think that? That takes a little explaining. Let's see if I can make this clear. Here is thing that can or not exist. Here's our sample thing. Now, if this is really something which can possibly not exist, there cannot be internal to it any reason that would prevent it from going out of existence. It has to be the kind of thing which doesn't contain within itself anything that would allow it to cease to exist. But it's also the case that there can't be any reason outside of it that prevents it from failing to exist. If either one of those were true, it would not be the kind of thing that can possibly not exist. So for anything to be this kind of thing, there can't be a reason external to it or internal to it that would prevent it from failing to exist. And you say, okay, so, all right. But this brings us to an assumption behind the argument. And that assumption is called the principle of sufficient reason. Thomas and almost every philosopher prior to him, and for, a good 500 years after him, held that this is an axiom that is true, the principle of sufficient reason. It goes like this. For everything, there must be a cause or explanation. I'll pause there and let you think about that in a minute. For everything, there must be a cause or an explanation. And that means that this thing could not continue to exist unless there were some cause or explanation. I've used the term reason to combine cause and explanation. Unless there were some reason for it. So what we have is this: the following. a thing is the kind of thing spoken of in premise one. It's something that can exist or not exist, only if there is no cause or explanation for its continuing to exist and never cease. But we've already said, if a thing is this kind of thing, it really can fail to exist. There's no reason within it, no reason outside of it, that would prevent that. Therefore, it can't happen. So premise two is a necessary truth if and only if the principle of sufficient reason is a necessary truth. Premise two assumes that for everything there must be a cause or explanation. Now you might want to feel like saying to me, well, wait a minute. If you say for everything there's a cause or explanation, then that would include God, wouldn't it? And he wouldn't want to say that. He wouldn't say there's a cause for God. And that's right. But there is an explanation, he thinks. And the explanation is simply that God's being is such that it can't fail to exist. The explanation is God is self-existent. God is God. So while the being of God has no cause, it has an explanation. God contains the explanation within himself. And you say, okay, what is that explanation exactly? Why is God like that? And Thomas' answer is, that explanation we know is known by God because God's omniscient and knows everything. We don't know what that is, but God does. So we know there is an explanation, even though there's no cause, because it's known to God because everything is. I don't know whether you feel at that point as though you're being tricked. I hope not. He's quite sincere about this. This is the reflection of a first-rate philosopher on his faith in relation to the principles of logic and the principle of sufficient reason. Anyway, I hope I've made clear here that there are some things that can fail to exist. Whatever is like that would have to fail to exist because there would be no cause or explanation for it to continue forever. And then we come to premise three. If everything were like that, if all things could fail to exist, then at some time everything would fail to exist and there would now be nothing. And of course he goes on, it's absurd that there's now nothing, that's false. Therefore it's false that all things can fail to exist. Therefore there's something that can't fail to exist. And then he ends, et hoc dicimus est Deus. And this we say is God. So what he's done is prove that there has to be something that can't fail to exist. And that something is the something we call God. This does not attempt to prove anything else about God other than his self-existence. That's all it tries to do. It doesn't try to show that God is in Trinity. It doesn't try to show that God cares about human beings, that he sent his son into the world to save rescue the world from sin and death. None of that. We don't get that out of this argument. All we get is there's something that can't fail to exist. And that we call God. And he has other arguments for other characteristics of God, and he concludes them all the same way. He had five proofs in total, and every one of them ends, and this, we say, is God. I can't ask you what you think of this argument. If you were here present, I would, and we'd have a little chat about this. It's an impressive attempt, but I don't think that it succeeds. And let me tell you why. First of all, some philosophers, since the 18th century, have denied the law of the principle of sufficient reason. They've said they didn't see any reason to think that there had to be a cause or explanation for anything, for everything. And how would you know that that itself is a necessary truth? Notice the principle says, for everything there must be, not there is. There has to be a cause or explanation. How would you know that? So some people have called this into question. Philosophers, by Thomas' time, all had held this, so he didn't think it was a problem. But from his time to ours, philosophers are divided. Some still accept the principle, some reject it. So that's one weakness. But well, by the time we get to premise three, we have something that's not just a weakness, but a well-known logical fallacy. In logic, it's called the fallacy of composition. And what it says is that the fallacy says you can't just say that because all the parts of something have a certain characteristic, the whole thing has it. Sometimes that's true and sometimes it isn't. Here's an example of when it isn't. Suppose every component of a certain machine was a light part, weighed an ounce or less. All the parts would be light. Would the whole machine be light? Not if it had a million parts. Each part would have that characteristic, but the whole would not. Now, as I said, sometimes it's correct to say of something that if all the parts have a certain characteristic, the whole has it. But because there are many times it's not true, you can't just say that because these parts have the characteristic, the whole does. That's not sufficient. That's just a fallacy. You would have to give special reasons for thinking that in this case, that characteristic carries over from the parts to the whole. And he doesn't have that here. What he says is, if everything were the kind of thing that could fail to exist, then the entirety of all things would have the property of being able to fail to exist and would, at some time, fail to exist. So it's a clear-cut case of the fallacy of composition. It does not follow that if each and everything could fail to exist, they'd all do it at the same time. Why couldn't some things come into existence, cause others, and then fail to exist, while the others go on and cause others, and then they fail to exist, so that at all times there would always be something, although things were failing to exist all the time as well. There's no reason he gives us that rescues this as one of the unusual circumstances in which all the parts of something having a characteristic does mean that the whole has the same characteristic. But that's what 3 hinges on. It hinges on accepting this premise, which embodies a logical fallacy. And that's his reason, though, for saying that if everything could fail, if everything were like the things in premise 1, if everything could fail to exist, there'd be nothing. And of course, premise 4, it's absurd that there's now nothing. You and I are here, the board is here, the argument, the books, the room. It's absurd that there's now nothing, from which it follows that not all things cannot exist. That logical move is a step called modus tollens in logic, and it's a perfectly valid one to make. If 3 and 4 were both true, they would require that it's false that all things are such that they can fail to exist. And that would entail that there is something that cannot not exist. It entails that there's at least one thing. Remember the meaning of some? At least one? It would show us, even if it were correct, even if there were no other problems with this argument, it would show us that there is at least one thing that cannot fail to exist. Why couldn't there be dozens or billions? It doesn't show us that there's only one thing that cannot fail to exist. And it's that latter belief that is equivalent to God. For a Christian, God is the only thing that cannot fail to exist. God is self-existent. All else is his creation. So I'm afraid that for several very good reasons, this attempt at proof fails. It fails because the principle of sufficient reason may be in doubt. That could be denied reasonably by someone, and then premise 2 would not be accepted by them. It fails because premise 3 commits a fallacy. And it fails because the conclusion is taken in the sense that there is only one thing, and that we call God. Not, and them we call gods, because it implies some undisclosed number of things could be such that they can't fail to exist. So, for as far as the premises go, it proves less than it should. As far as the conclusion goes, it proves more than it should, if it proves anything. And I think it doesn't. This, however, is a famous argument for the existence of God. It's still examined and studied, and it still has people that try to fix it up and defend it. They try to reword some of the premises to avoid these objections. I know one professor who said, I don't need to assume the principle of sufficient reason. I don't have to assume that for everything there must be a cause or explanation. All I would have to do is assume that it is possible that for everything there is a cause or explanation. So I don't have to defend the principle as a necessary truth. And this whole thing will still work then. That's an example of an attempt to defend it. Of course, many of you would probably never thought about the principle of sufficient reason before. Why would you? It doesn't come up over tea. But it's a serious issue still in philosophy, and a lot of people are inclined to say, "Yeah, but I think it's right. For everything, there would have to be a cause or explanation." If you do believe that, though, you would have to defend it in some way. You would have to claim that it's self-evident, or you would have to give something like a reason to believe it. And one of the reasons a lot of people are inclined to say they believe it is that they believe in God. You see, they believe that, in fact, there is a cause or explanation for everything other than God, and the cause or explanation is God. And that would be one way to go, but he couldn't take that view, see? Because if he said the principle is true because God exists, then the whole argument would beg the question. He'd be premising God and concluding God. And that makes the argument circular and worthless. That ends my treatment of this proof. Now, that tradition of offering proofs for the existence of God, as I already said, started long before Thomas. And it hasn't stopped.